You're listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Coming up next, Economics for the People with your hosts, Sirisha Naidu and Taki Manolakos.
Tú nos dices que debemos sentarnos, pero las ideas solo pueden levantarnos, caminar, recorrer, no rendirse ni retroceder, ver, aprender cómo esponja absorbe. Nadie sobre todos, faltan todos, suman todos para todos, todo para nosotros. Soñamos en grande que se...
Welcome everyone to Economics for the People with your co-hosts Taki Manolakos and Sirisha Naidu. Hey Sirisha, how you doing today? It looks like winter has finally come to Kansas City.
Hey Taki, and hello to all our listeners. Yes, it is cold today. I'm trying to stay warm, but irrespective, we have a good show lined up for our listeners today. In our Econ 101 section, we discuss WIC, which is the supplemental nutrition for women, infants, and children, and the fact that it might be underfunded in 2024.
Yes, and following our WIC discussion, we have our DNS or Dollars and Cents debrief with co-editor Chris Durr, who interviews Robert Ovetz for us. Robert discusses artificial intelligence and the future of work.
Oh, that sounds really, really interesting. I can't wait to hear that. And then finally, in our feature, we're in conversation with Rasha Abu Salem and Suhaib Azar, where we talk about life in Palestine.
Thanks for joining us, everyone. Let's get started.
It's the holiday season and we are overwhelmed with images and advertisements for consumption. In last month's show, we discussed the impact of advertisements. The other issue that comes to mind during the holiday season is food. We associate the holidays with food and feasts, but we know that not everyone has access to food.
Yes, Sirisha, that is a very good point. The proportion of food insecure households has been increasing in the last few years. Food insecure households who had difficulty at some point of the year providing enough food for all of their members because of a lack of resources. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, 12.8% of households were food insecure and in 2022, and this is up from 10.2% in 2021. Now, while this may seem like a small percentage, it does add up to 17 million food insecure households in 2022. This translates to 44.2 million people in households that have difficulty getting enough food for everyone. Now, not only that, I know that's a lot of numbers we just threw at you, but among households with children, 17.3% or 6.4 million households were food insecure. And some of these households, only the adults were food insecure, meaning that they had to reduce food consumption or change consumption patterns. But in 3.3 million households, both adults and children were food insecure. This translates to about 7.3 million children that may be going to bed hungry.
Those are some pretty significant numbers. Those are millions of kids and millions of adults going to bed hungry. Now, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, or the USDA, is a federal agency that oversees and supports agriculture, food, nutrition, and rural development in the U.S. And it administers 15 domestic food and nutrition assistance programs and spent $183 billion on these in 2022, so roughly two-thirds of its annual budget. Now, $183 billion might sound like a lot, but just for comparison, the annual Pentagon budget exceeds $700 billion. Now, an important program to fight food insecurity funded by the USDA is WIC. It stands for the Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children. And it safeguards the health of low-income women, infants, and children up to the age of 5. Now, most state WIC programs provide vouchers that participants can use at authorized food stores. And a variety of state and local organizations cooperate in providing the food and healthcare benefits. And there are about 46,000 merchants nationwide that accept WIC vouchers. And so many of us may have actually seen in the stores that we frequent some indication that they accept WIC vouchers. And more recently, there have been farmers markets that have also started to accept WIC vouchers. So, Taki, well and good that there's a program like WIC. It sounds so important. But is there any research on the impact of this program?
Yes. WIC? The USDA's Economic Research Service has conducted some high-quality research based on data made available by federal and state agencies and sometimes collects its own data. This research is meant to help public policy at the federal and state level, as well as farm and industry groups. So what has ERS found? Well, we have a long list of results for you.
And ERS, again, for our listeners, is the Economic Research Service associated with the USDA.
So ERS found that WIC reduces fetal deaths and infant mortality. It alleviates low birth weights and increases the duration of pregnancy. It improves the growth of nutritionally at-risk infants and children. WIC decreases the incidence of iron deficiency anemia in children, improves the dietary intake of pregnant and postpartum women, and improves weight gain in pregnant women. Pregnant women participating in WIC receive prenatal care earlier. Children enrolled in WIC are more likely to have a regular source of medical care and have more up-to-date immunizations. WIC helps children get ready to start school. Children who receive WIC benefits demonstrate improved intellectual development. And finally, WIC significantly improves children's diets.
That's quite impressive, Taki. And what is clear is that WIC doesn't just benefit the participants directly, but it also has this impact on society as a whole. But I have heard that this program is at risk of a funding shortfall to the tune of $1 billion. According to a press statement released by the USDA, Congress has indicated that the USDA and state should serve everyone who's eligible, but they haven't actually provided the funds to cover the program once resources run out. Now, Congress, on a bipartisan basis, has fully funded WIC for more than 25 years. So every year since 1997, even in years when WIC's funding needs were growing and budgetary resources were constrained by funding limitations, Congress has prioritized resources for WIC to ensure that the program had sufficient funding to serve every eligible low-income family who sought benefits in recognition of WIC's demonstrated effectiveness and positive impacts on children's health and development. And of course, this is quite significant. Both sides of the political aisle recognized how important this program was. But without sufficient funding, the program will have to turn away at least 2 million young children and pregnant and postpartum adults nationwide by September 2024. And this will disproportionately impact Black and Hispanic families, but also all working class, low-income households and families. So what is actually going on?
In fiscal year 2022, WIC enrolled 182,000 participants. In the first 10 months of fiscal 23, more than 304,000 new participants enrolled in WIC, almost a doubling. Since 2018, children's participation in WIC has increased by 18%. These numbers themselves are indicative of the hunger crisis in the U.S. I already gave some numbers related to food insecurity, but we also see this, of course, on the news all the time. You know, we have growing lines at food pantries. This is actually a reality. We have a problem of food insecurity. Now, in our Econ 101 a couple months ago, we discussed inflation and cost of living adjustments. So even though unemployment levels are low and wages have increased slightly, food prices have also increased, and this is impacting households in the U.S. substantially. But the important point is that when food prices go up, the cost of funding WIC goes up too, right? Because WIC is paying for food.
Absolutely, yes.
Now, additionally, COVID-era benefits have started to end. In February 2023, temporary benefit increases under the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, emergency allotments ended. Eligible households across the country suffered from anywhere between $95 to $250 lower benefits. Federal and state policymakers have worked very hard for many years to connect more low-income families to WIC's proven benefits. In 2021, for instance, only 51% of eligible people actually took advantage of the program. That means there are people who are eligible in WIC, and that's a considerable number of them, that either don't know or for some reason are not applying for benefits. The perception that WIC is not available to those who need it, even in the short term, will leave a lasting impression that could discourage eligible families from applying.
So, Thaki, what I'm hearing you say is that any funding shortfall would have serious long-term implications for WIC beyond the end of fiscal year 2024. So as we approach a new year with our new year resolutions, let's hope that Congress resolves to at least take this minimal step to alleviate food insecurity.
This is the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine.
My name is Chris Sturr. I'm co-editor of Dollars and Cents, and I'm here with Robert Ovetz, who's a lecturer at UC Berkeley and San Jose State University. And he's also the author of our current cover story, which is called AI and the Future of Work. So, Robert, why don't you start us off by just talking about how the current form of AI that everybody's excited about, which they call generative AI, how that's different from previous efforts to automate work.
Sure, Chris. Thanks for having me. So I think the way to distinguish between automation AI and generative AI is to recognize that automation, first off, is the introduction of any sort of machinery that replaces human labor. These are essentially big dumb machines that are programmed to do some tasks that a human laborer would do. In contrast to that, AI is programmed to be able to complete a task, but it's able to interpret new information based on its programming. The difference between AI and generative AI is that generative AI can create something new. And it does this by making decisions, predicting outcomes, and solving problems, and in the process, creating new data by finding patterns in the data. So the way to think about it is AI completes tasks using the existing data, but generative AI uses the existing data to create new data. And the way I think about this is, for example, if you ask AI to show you windows. AI will go through all the existing data. It will interpret what a window is, and it will show you pictures of windows. Generative AI will go through all the existing data, and it will synthesize everything it has in its data about windows and generate an image of a window. So that's the way to understand the difference between these three.
Okay, that's helpful. So I mean, a lot of what you do in the article is talk about the wide range of jobs that could be and will be affected by this new technology, but also a lot of them that already are being affected. So maybe you could talk a little bit about that.
Right. So there's been a lot of hype, especially since ChatGPT was released to the public. What is it, like a year ago or now or so now? I see it quite commonly now with students that are trying to submit work that's clearly written by ChatGPT. And it created a kind of sensation, but it wasn't a new sensation. But the sensation was this new generative AI, and let's just call it AI. You know, will AI destroy jobs? Will humans no longer be needed to work? And the story really is not a new one. It's something that I talk about in the article. For example, 50 years ago, a French sociologist wrote a book exploring this, and it was a widely read book. His name was André Gorz, and Gorz in Path to Paradise explored this possibility that at that time he called it automation, whether it would make humans obsolete or superfluous. The reality is that AI is like any other technology, really, the way it's introduced into the workplace is it's intended to break up, or what Harry Braverman famously called, the rationalization of labor. It's intended to break up what we do into its component parts, what we call rationalization, and to identify certain tasks that can be done by generative AI, and then leaving the rest of the work for the worker to conduct, or outsourcing it, or sending it abroad, or whatever it might be. Now, the data on how extensive this will be is really mixed. And I kind of explore some of the ranges of different kinds of work that will be replaced by AI and is being replaced. And we know that its greatest impact really is on administrative office support, writing, simple writing, any job that has simple writing tasks, and then illustrators and data processing. It looks like AI is already starting to replace, not necessarily entire workers, but it's starting to replace large chunks of the work that people doing these kinds of tasks are already doing. The prognosis, though, and let's take this with a grain of salt, the prognosis is mostly coming from the manufacturers of AI and researchers that they support. And they're showing huge dystopian futures in which hundreds of millions of workers will lose their jobs in the next decade or so. But I think the reality is somewhere in between. It's already starting to happen. It's going to happen particularly with particular kinds of tasks that workers do. And it's not going to immediately make any particular type of work obsolete. And that raises all kinds of questions, of course, for us of how do we deal with it?
Right. I mean, you talk about the dystopian predictions, and one of the fun things about your article is that you use science fiction movies as a way to help readers understand what the possible futures are. So maybe you could just mention a couple of those and how they relate to what you're talking about.
Perhaps my favorite movie that deals with this issue is Elysium. And Elysium is about how humanity has become completely superfluous. It's kind of a reference to Hannah Arendt's book on the origins of totalitarianism. And so the planet is wasted. It's apocalyptic. The population is controlled by AI, robot police. And the only job available, the main character, is to produce the robots that dominate the human population. The ruling class, the elites, if you will, live on an artificial moon close to the planet. They essentially can live forever because they have this healthcare technology that cures every ailment they might have. And it demonstrates perhaps the most extreme of the dystopian future visions. But what's interesting about Elysium, like many other films, some of those in the Avengers series, for example, and science fiction books and stories, is that we've been warned about this for a very long time. Uh-huh. And one of the ironies of this is that we just saw a 4-month-long strike by Hollywood writers and actors. And one of the main issues they had was automation destroying their jobs. And I found that to be really paradoxical, because here are the folks that are writing these stories and are acting in them, and they are actually going on strike in reaction to the attempt to use AI to make them obsolete. But these Hollywood films have just really preceded what we're talking about right now with the impact of AI on work.
So I want to talk about the Elysium and the ruling elites and the robots. And so see if you can talk a little bit about class power and social control and how this all relates to it. Because I mean, just to take one sentence from your article, you say the robot apocalypse is not that robots will take our jobs. It is that work will no longer keep us under control. In our world, what's happening as far as social control and AI?
Right. To be able to answer that question, I think back to what Karl Marx wrote in Capital Volume 1, when he said that it would be possible to write a whole history of the inventions made since 1830 for the sole purpose of providing capital with a weapon against working class revolt. And the way I look at this and how I write about capitalism in my own books and my other writings is that I see the introduction of technology as a response to the power of workers.
Right.
And there's this built-in paradox to capitalism that Marx explored and others have followed in the tradition of what's known as zero work, named after a short-lived journal in the 1970s. And that is that capitalism has this built-in paradox that it needs to be able to maintain control over its human working population in order to exploit the labor to the maximum. Mm-hmm. The problem is workers don't just passively go along with that,
mm-hmm.
that they organize and they rebel and they strike and they revolt. And so capital responds by introducing new forms of management, new rules, but also new tools, new technologies. And I see AI as just the latest iteration of that.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is that when new technologies and new rules are introduced, this reduces capital's reliance on human workers. And so that's the reason why, and this is something that's explored in the magazine quite frequently, is that productivity rates have outpaced wage increases for the last 50 years, right, during the neoliberal era. There's a problem, though, is that the more and more, say, an hour of human labor can produce, the less and less human workers are needed. But the problem is we live in not just a capitalist system, but we live in a capitalist society. And as I see it, society is organized around work. And the way to maintain social control is to keep people employed. Keynes, who I think is credited with famously saying, you know, you can employ an entire population by paying them to dig holes and then pay them to fill them back up. And that's really what the role of work is. It's a way to maintain control. Now, the problem with AI is that if ultimately the vast supermajority of the human population is no longer needed to do the work, well, what's the replacement system for maintaining control over the population? And that brings us back to André Gorz, and that's the conundrum that he faced in his book, Paths to Paradise. He ended up thinking that it was going to end up with a kind of dystopian, kind of pseudo-totalitarian system where there's a small number of elite workers who still have jobs, but everybody else is essentially maintained, under the control of a brutal ruling class. And this is something that's replicated in films like Elysium, right? That the entire human population is just under the thumb of these AI robots. The answer to that, I think, though, is how AI ultimately demonstrates the weakness of that system of control, that the reliance on human labor is not only the main source for capital to maintain control and the reproduction of the system, but it also demonstrates a vulnerability that we as human workers can also take advantage of. And that's what's missing from the conversation. And that's what motivated me to write this piece is how do we respond to that? And there's, you know, I could go into this, but there's a number of different strategies that can be pursued of how we deal with this new type of technology.
Yeah. So why don't you go through what are the ways out of this problem and how can workers sort of get more control?
Right. So I don't know what the way out is. If I think anybody had found it, you know, we would be doing it. But I think there's a range of different strategies that are now being attempted. I think we could start with first that AI should be regulated. And this is something that the industry wants, right? They want clear rules so that we can't ban it. In Europe, a lot of the unions are attempting to do this, for example, by building in rights for workers in their contracts, making the AI transparent so that if there's mistakes in the data, that it can be challenged and removed by workers. I don't think much of that approach. Another approach that's more of a social democratic approach is something I talked about with Boston University professor Julia Shore, who argues that If we look back to the period from the 1870s to the 1940s, as productivity increased and the workers' movement became more powerful in the 30s, we were able to ratchet down work hours and work lives and create pensions and redistribute some of the excess productivity. We're not in that era anymore, but one possibility is to turn the increasing productivity from the introduction of AI and follow Professor Shor's idea of reducing work hours, work lives, et cetera, right? The approach that I tend to favor is that we need to democratize our economic system entirely. And I don't think, considering the situation that we face with climate catastrophe and the introduction of AI into the use of weapons, for example, that's being used in Gaza right now, I think we run into a great danger that we leave control of AI in the hands of the corporations that are producing it. And I think that we need to address the issue of control over work, who makes decisions about what we do, what we produce, how we do it, whether we do it at all. And that means entirely democratizing our economic system. And that means moving past capitalism. And so I look at, in the article, these three different strategic approaches and assess, which one would be most effective.
All right, well, that's super helpful. I hope people will pick up the latest issue and take a look at your article. Thanks so much.
I hope so too. You're welcome, Chris.
All right, take care.
This has been the DNS Debrief from Dollars and Cents Magazine. For more economic analysis, visit dollarsandcents.org.
That was Can I Live by MC Abdul.
When conflict happens, it's sometimes difficult for us to grasp the root causes. Not only that, since we often get our information from biased corporate media, it's sometimes difficult to understand how conflict, or in the case of Palestine, occupation, impacts the everyday life of real people. In our feature today, we go beyond the headlines. We welcome two guests that will help us unpack the everyday lives of Palestinians in the occupied territories. We're streaming from Kansas City, with a population of 2 million, approximately similar to the population in Gaza, at least before the conflict. Of course, Gaza is much smaller in terms of its area, so its population density is much higher. What's life like for people living in a refugee camp? What's it like to have to deal with military checkpoints when you're trying to get to work so that you can feed your family? We'll address these questions and more in this segment.
We welcome today Soheib Azza, a Palestinian refugee from the Aida refugees camp. He is also co-founder of Al Hadaf, an activist for liberation of Palestine, Palestinians' right of return and self-determination. And we have with us Rasha Abu Salem, who is a humanitarian aid worker. She's visited over 40 refugee campsites since 2014. She's delivered aid and assistance for underprivileged refugee and indigenous populations throughout the Middle East, Europe, South Asia, and the Americas. She has a master's in international relations and a certificate in international security, both from Harvard University. She's done extensive research on the sexual exploitation of unaccompanied refugee boys and sexual gender-based violence against males. She's also an adjunct professor teaching a course on international conflict resolution. Rasha is also an American Red Cross volunteer who presents on international humanitarian law and rules of war. So Soheib and Rasha, welcome to the show and thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Soheib, you actually lived in Palestine and you're born in Palestine. Soheib, can you tell us a little bit about which part of Palestine you're from? And then what do you remember most about the landscape and geography? So what is your most happiest memory from your time at home?
No, absolutely. So I was born and raised in Aida refugee camp. It's north of Bethlehem City. Lived there my entire life until I was 18, 19 before I left. When it comes to happy memories, living one under occupation and two in a refugee camp, we make up almost silly things to be excited and looking forward to. I do remember we used to go run to our neighbor's house. They had almond trees, and we would just sneak a few almond, and then we eat them with salt. But yeah, living in a refugee camp, especially looking back at it now, you don't really recall a lot of happy memories. Most of the memories you have is just everyday occupation, and we try to make the most out of it.
And so how did you end up in Kansas City then?
After I finished high school, my father actually forced me to leave to study abroad because, again, the situation in Palestine, as soon as you pass the age of 16 or 18, you become targeted by the Israeli occupation forces. Sometimes they will arrest people just for no reason. So he didn't want me to go through that. But I came to the U.S. in 2013 to study here at UMKC.
Okay. And you still have family back in Palestine?
Yes. Yeah. All of my family is still in Palestine.
Can you give us information about life in the camp under the occupation? Did your parents work? How did you get money to buy food and economic necessities?
So living in a refugee camp, especially in my case, in Aida camp, it'll be easier just with visuals to explain how it looks like. But two-thirds of our camp is essentially surrounded by an apartheid separation wall, which they built in 2004. So we only have one exit to the city of Bethlehem. My father is a teacher. He used to teach in the UNRWA schools under the UN. And then now he's a teacher in public school. That's how my dad provided for the family. But generally speaking, for the camp, we do have a lot of educated people with higher degrees, masters, even PhD. But unfortunately enough, because we're under occupation, it is difficult to be able to get the job, especially in your field or something that you want to do. You see a big portion of the people in the camp working in the construction or even having to establish like a little vegetable/fruits cart so they can provide for their families. But at the end of the day, we make it work. We adapt to it. And the refugee camp, as ugly as it is, given how we ended up there, it's a waiting station for us. Our parents and grandparents, they were forced to leave their home villages back in 48, thinking that they're going to come back in a week or so. And we've been waiting since 1948 till this day. Everything that I thought normal growing up in Palestine, especially in the refugee camp, it became not normal at all because I've seen what life could look like outside of the camp in a free country where you have all your rights. But yeah, generally speaking, the camp is, don't get me wrong, I love the camp and I love my people, but it's not where I want to be. Yes. I was forced to be a refugee in my own homeland.
Yeah. And Asha, Suhaib described the situation in his particular refugee camp. Given your experience as a humanitarian worker, can that be generalized? I'm thinking also about camps in Jordan. Is the situation similar in Jordan? Can you elaborate?
Just to add on a little bit, if you don't mind, real quick. So my father was born in Haifa in 1940. Him and his family were forced out of their homes and became refugees by the time he was 8. So when he was in the refugee camps in Lebanon, so he was part of that Palestinian diaspora that was forced to leave and part of that refugee community. And when he was 8 years old, there was a little school system, if you want to call it, just a tent where they could have the kids get some type of education in the meantime. And he was forced by his mother out of school when he was 8 and forced to work on the streets because that was the only way for them to be able to afford even the basics. And so he had been working since he was a child. This is incredibly common, unfortunately, when you're talking about the refugee population outside now of Palestine. So whether it's Jordan, Lebanon, or Syria, or anywhere. And fortunately, when it comes to, let's say specifically the Palestinian population in foreign countries, a lot of them, the vast majority, they don't just, and this is quite common, what I'm about to say, it's quite common for a refugee population in general around the world. They don't get the same rights that the locals do. So even something like a work permit is incredibly difficult for them to get. So they are restricted in the kinds of work they can do, even sometimes having just freedom of movement, whether it's inside or outside of the camp, to leave the camp and come back. So you're talking about in addition to being refugees, now they're also limited in the kind of work they can get and how often they can get it. So that is quite common, unfortunately, and quite common across the board when it comes to Palestinian and general, just the general refugee population.
Gaza, for a very long time, has been described as the world's largest open-air prison. So can you just give us a sense of that? How are people getting anything that they need if, you know, life is so hard?
Absolutely. I'm going to leave the Gaza portion to Rasha, but to speak about in the West Bank in general and in the refugee camps. So one of the things that limits our movement and our daily life is we're, one, under occupation. We don't control our borders. They're controlled by the Israeli occupation. And the amount of stuff coming in and out of the West Bank, and even worse, especially in Gaza Strip, is calculated based on the population. And you can see that case, especially in Gaza. But for the West Bank, we are forced, for the most part, to either buy the occupation products because they won't allow any other products to be in the West Bank. And if there's any alternative, you either see price being more expensive, and two, basic necessity like water, electricity, and just basic human needs. Especially in the refugee camps, you're deprived of, like, for example, in the summer, we're very short on water. We might get a week worth of water, and they would cut it off for another month or so. Same situation in the winter, where we're having issues with the electricity. You would get 10, 12 hours of power during the day, and then it would cut off for the rest of it. And sometimes we get either a full day with no power, so... Again, all of this, growing up in the refugee camp, thought was normal. This is what life looks like, and we adapted and lived accordingly. But come to find out that, no, this is not normal. And it's even 10 times worse in Gaza Strip, especially in times like this.
So when it comes to Gaza, before October 7th, and, you know, your question is twofold when it comes to being able to just survive. So you have... Obviously, employment is a big aspect of it, but when it comes to Gaza specifically, it's employment issues and access to aid, because as you described it, Gaza is known as the world's largest open-air prison because it has been under a complete blockade from the Israeli government since 2006. Before October 7th, let's say, for example, the unemployment rate in Gaza was about 45%. Now, after October 7th, currently, it is sitting at 85%. So 85% of the population in Gaza is unemployed. And before October 7th, 40% of the population in Gaza needed humanitarian assistance. Now, about 80% of Gazans need some form of aid, and it's skyrocketing. The work that is available, or the items that are available to be purchased, this is coming from friends that I have on the ground there telling me, they are incredibly inflated prices, and I'll use the words they use to describe it. Water is like gold. Bread lines are hours long, and that's assuming you could get the bread that you need. Eggs are incredibly hard to get. You know, just the basic necessities are incredibly difficult to get. So that's one portion. Now you have the other portion, say, for example, the humanitarian aid trucks. So the UN says, in general, for humanitarian crisis, in general, you would need about 100 to 200 trucks a day. Now, before October 7th, Gaza was getting 500 trucks a day of humanitarian aid. Since then, it has received maybe just a total, in about 2-3 months, just several hundred. And the trucks aren't always full, no less. And what people don't realize is the trucks that come in from Egypt, they have to cross the Rafah border from Egypt. They have to cross into Gaza. They have to be emptied out from the Egyptian trucks and then put back into Palestinian trucks. And then on top of that, they have to be inspected by Israeli soldiers before they can actually go in and be distributed. And a lot of that aid currently is only being distributed to the displaced Palestinians. I think it's about 1.5 million or so. So the people who live in Gaza in the south are not able to really get their hands on any of that aid, because that aid is really meant for the displaced Palestinians that came down from the north. You know, it's only a matter of time that every Palestinian in Gaza is going to be completely displaced. As we could see, the bombardments have only intensified and are moving further and further south. So the economy has come to pretty much a complete standstill in Gaza, and this is just a humanitarian nightmare.
And I think it's so important for us to understand that the situation in Palestine was extremely hard even before October 7th. Russia, you said 45% unemployment. I mean, that is so unimaginable to someone being here, but this is everyday life for very significant proportion of the population living in Gaza.
And if I can give a point of reference, the unemployment rate in the U.S. during the Great Depression at its maximum was 25%.
Yes. And then you're talking about humanitarian aid, which was the lifeline for people in Gaza and the West Bank. And now for people in Gaza, it's become even harder to get basic necessities outside of being under this constant bombardment. You know, so thank you for highlighting that, because the news represents this as something that's happening since October 7th. The other thing, Suhaib, you mentioned, which is the water supply. We know that supply of water to Gaza has been restricted even before October 7th. How did people even get water?
It's a great question, and thank you for that. The Israeli occupation essentially controls, I want to say, almost every aspect of the Palestinians in Palestine. They do control all the water resources, even though in some cases, let's say for the West Bank, there are some areas where they should be falling under the jurisdiction and the authority of the Palestinian Authority. But even in those areas, the occupation controls all these resources. So we don't have access to, let's say, source the water and use it and distribute it as it should be with all Palestinians, and the occupation does. And with that, and as we saw in Gaza Strip, again, since October 7th, they shut off water just mm-hmm. like that. People in Gaza, they refer to it now as the sweet water. Mm-hmm. And because, again, till this day, they cut off water completely on the Gaza Strip. And people either have to go back to get water from the sea and try to filter it, or with what Russia mentioned, with these very, very, very minimum amount of aid trucks that go in, that, again, used to get in 500 trucks a day, and now we're barely getting maybe 300 or 400 trucks in the past 2 months to try to cover the needs of 2 million plus people living in Gaza. So yeah, at the moment, again, basic human need everyone should have access to, we do not. And okay. It's controlled of how many we can consume. Yeah. And I believe we covered this in one of the sessions that we do with Al Hadaf in terms of what the UN Health Organization calls for the minimum water liters that a human needs a day, right, versus what people in Gaza are getting today. I mean, the normal is 130 liters a day between drinking, and then they're getting less than 3 liters a day now.
So just to add on to what Suhaib was saying, also, you know, just as a reminder, in the West Bank territory, 60-65% of it now has been taken over by illegal Israeli settlements, and those settlements get unrestricted water. So what Suhaib was describing, that the Palestinians in the West Bank get maybe 2-3 days a week of water, let's say, when it comes to the illegal Israeli settlements in the West Bank, they get unrestricted water. And again, that's by design. So there's it's not an accident here. This is meant to specifically be as a some type of punishment for the Palestinians in the West Bank. Now, in Gaza, what's really important here to remember is, you know, we talk about the restrictions to food, water, fuel. Now, when it comes to water, what is important for people to remember is that before October 7th, 90% of the water in Gaza was unfit for human consumption. And this is according to the UN and other organizations. So this is, again, really important to remember, because it's not just the restriction of the water now. Even before, it was never proper for people to drink. And there are several water treatment plants, but some of them have been bombed by Israel now as well. Mm-hmm. So it's not just that they're restricting the water. Now they can't, whatever water they do have, a lot of it can't be treated. So, and this is, again, a lot of people don't realize this. This, like you were saying earlier, October 7th wasn't the start. This goes decades mm-hmm. before October 7th. And this is, again, something, a really important note for people to start understanding.
You know, in your experience, how do you see this not having access to sufficient water, which is so, so important for all living beings?
Water is a necessity of life. It's that simple. So when you're restricting water and just like food, even the most basic food, you cannot live without these items. So for them to be restricted to an entire population of people that are already, that have no way of getting out to get those necessities. So you've locked them in, and now you've deprived them of the basic necessities to live. Again, that's incredibly just cruel and clearly a form of collective punishment that should not be taking place. So when it comes to water specifically, it's not just for drinking. It's used for cooking. It's used to clean, for cleaning oneself. So you're talking about, you can't drink it. Now they can't. They're limited on what they could cook if they don't have water. And on top of that, they're limited in how they clean themselves. Now, that might sound, you know, some people just might chuckle and say, oh, that means they're smelly. It's not just that. Now you're talking about infectious diseases that are now, and we know they're spreading like wildfire in Gaza right now. Mm-hmm. So we're talking about spread of diseases. You're talking about now even limiting further what food, what little food you can consume. And on top of that, you're talking about dehydration and the risk of dying from dehydration. So again, water is a basic necessity, but it impacts so many different parts of living. And like you were saying, we take it for granted. We, you know, water in the other camps I've been to, water is one of those basic necessities. That is usually one of the first things I see if there's a need for water and non-perishable food items. And this is clearly an issue in a lot of other situations. So water is definitely one of those human rights issues that are being deprived, purposely deprived to Palestinians at the moment.
Since we're on the water subject, but water in a different form, there's apparently a lot of flooding now happening in Gaza. I'm wondering, either of you can address this, but flooding, we know in general, often comes with a lot of infectious diseases and a lot of other health problems for people that are exposed to it. And now we have displaced persons living in tents, which are severely flooded. Can you elaborate a little bit on how the flooding has affected the situation?
Yeah, so this is something that a lot of people tend to overlook. And it's really because it's not one of those things that we take so for granted, and we depend on the professionals to deal with that in our everyday life. We don't tend to think of it. So think of, like, for example, the sewage system. When there's flooding, a lot of that part of the sewage system, a lot of it will overflow. So now you're talking about, especially in Gaza, you're talking about flooding out of sewage systems. So now you're talking about human waste in the flooded waters that people are walking and wading through. You're talking about those who have been deceased and they haven't been buried. So now you're talking about the fluids from the corpses that are now being, people are now being exposed to in the waters. This is something I've dealt with in areas that I've traveled to, where it comes to human, for example, feces, urine, other bodily fluids. You're talking about improper sewage systems. I mean, it could be incredibly dangerous. I've been at risk many times being in the field and being exposed to diseases because of flooding or excessive rain that's caused a lot of mixture of mud and, again, just other fluids. So on top of that, of being exposed to such dangers, it also limits accessibility. So how people can move, how they could either escape, if they can, the bombardment, how they could access the aid that they need to get to. Again, the flooding now is just another element of the suffering that the Palestinian people in Gaza are going through.
And this is this intensification of the bombardment plus the displacement plus the not having access to basic necessities, and then now also having to deal with all the problems that flooding entails. Going back to this situation of employment, and you said that 45% unemployment and then now 85% unemployment in Gaza. And the Israeli regime has reportedly approached the Indian government to request that they send about 100,000 Indian workers to replace Palestinians who were previously employed by them, particularly in the construction industry, but elsewhere too. What impact will this have both on employment and jobs for Palestinians, but also the general morale if workers were brought from outside of the region?
So just to give a little context here, what generally the economy looks like in Palestine. So within the Palestinian territories are under Palestinian Authority, or even in Gaza Strip, being under occupation, we don't really have the basic elements to have an established economy. Again, this is occupied territory where we don't control our borders, imports, exports. in the case of Gaza Strip, they are heavily monitored and controlled. If, again, just the basic needs they control. And I read this article that they calculate how many calories per person, and based on that, they let aid in and food. So the basic needs, basic definition and elements for economy does not really exist in Palestine. And we heavily rely essentially on what the occupation let us do or not do. So a lot of the Palestinian population, especially in the West Bank, they, because of the workforce and what opportunities they have, specifically, let's say, in the West Bank, they're forced to go work within, but we refer to them as the Palestinian land occupied in 1948. So they go and work inside that green line to make a living and feed their families.
Can you just elaborate for our listeners, what is the green line?
So the green line is borderline, let's call it, between the territories that are supposed to be controlled by the Palestinians versus the Israelis, established by the UN in resolution number 181, where they said, we're going to take the Palestinian land and then split it into two. Again, they don't have a right to do so, but they did, especially with the Nakba, which means the catastrophe that happened in 1948. So now you have a lot of the Palestinian workforce working inside the occupied land, essentially giving to their economy, to the occupation economy, and buildings, infrastructure, and whatnot. So for them, it almost feels like the West Bank is a cheap source of labor, where they can get workers and laborers to go work at a cheaper, much cheaper cost than having Israeli workforce do the same job. So we have a lot of, there's a good portion of Palestinians that work inside the green line, because, again, given the situation that the Palestinians are under occupation, we don't have a lot of opportunities to advance or better our economy. So for the occupation to go ask the Indian government to get 100,000 workers, this is, in my opinion, an idea for them to have a backup plan, just in case their plan goes through of displacing and ethnic cleanse all Palestinians out of Palestine. They still want to be able to get that cheap labor to keep their economy going.
Yes, thank you for that answer. I just want to read a little bit here. In a collective statement released on November 9th, the All India Central Council of Trade Unions, which represents 100 million Indian workers, urged the Indian government to decline Israel's request within the construction sector to substitute Palestinian workers with Indian laborers amid the ongoing situation in Gaza. And in the U.S., the UAW, the largest union in the country, issued a statement calling for a ceasefire. They joined other unions like the American Postal Workers Union, United Electrical, Radio and Machine Workers, the International Union of Painters and Allied Trades, and a long list of others, including the Chicago Teachers Union, in the call for a ceasefire. Could both of you comment on this? Why is it important that workers in the U.S. support struggling people in Palestine?
That's a great question. And, you know, it's, again, touching back on what Suhaib was saying about how Palestinians are forced to work within Israel and out of no other option, really. So that's part of that. You were talking about that cruel system and the cycle that has been going on for generations. And really, you know, as a reminder, an apartheid system, the case that we're seeing here with the Palestinians, it's not just a physical occupation and apartheid. It's very much a psychological apartheid and occupation. And part of that is that reminder that you are under, or as they'd like you to see, under their feet. Of course, mm-hmm. Palestinians would never refer to themselves in such a way, but this is exactly how the Israeli government would like them to see it. And part of that is that's why you have so many checkpoints, and that's why you have such mm-hmm. a long process to just be able to simply go to work and then come back. I mean, it could take hours and hours, and that's if you're lucky enough to actually get through the checkpoints to get to your job or to get to your medical appointments within the Israeli area. So why it's so important when workers around the world show their solidarity with the Palestinians is because it's starting to break away from that narrative that Zionists have worked so long and hard for against the Palestinians, that narrative of you have to support Israel. If you don't support Israel, then you're supporting militants or extremists, or you're supporting anti-Jewish sentiment. You know, again, this narrative that they have drilled in people for so long, and now so many people have seen Israeli aggression for what it is and have understood the occupation and the apartheid in such a newly profound way. And for workers, especially, to stand with Palestinian workers, I think it's incredibly important, because it's showing that shift in the narrative that we've been waiting for so long. And it also puts a lot of pressure on just society in general. And when we talk about things like this can easily lead to an increase in boycott or in divestment and sanctions. Especially, we've seen this in South African apartheid towards its end, where you started having this awakening from society and the international communities. And that ultimately greatly helped in breaking down that apartheid. And I'm not saying afterwards everything was perfect, by no means is it. But again, helping to break down that apartheid, and that was done because people started to show solidarity with those who were oppressed.
And, you know, just speaking of South Africa, of course, there is a significant amount of support for Palestine and the Palestinian cause in South Africa for just the reasons that you mentioned, Rasha. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to put it into perspective, just to give an example of what Russia mentioned about checkpoints. Because I was one of those people here in Kansas City where I lived in Overland Park, but I worked in Midtown, Kansas City, Missouri. So you're traveling from Overland Park to Kansas City, Missouri, downtown area. It would take you roughly about 20, 25 minutes, 30 if there's traffic. In Palestine, that same distance, it would take you, roughly speaking, between 3 hours to maybe 6, sometimes, again, that's if you're lucky, if you get through. They have major checkpoints between all the major cities in the West Bank, and they have what we call them on-the-fly checkpoints, where they can set up at any random moment in the street and just start blocking cars, asking where you're going, why, who's with you, IDs. And that's one of the things that we always have to have on is your Palestinian ID, because if you don't, you will get in a lot of serious trouble. But going back to the unions, historically speaking, the working class, the middle class, has been the main actor in political history and in essentially the faith of countries and states. They change the course of history throughout the world. And they're the one that make up the most amount of people in society, and they have the power to change the conditions that they're living in. We're living in, especially in Palestine, in this oppression, apartheid, and occupation, and settler colonialism. And to see the union, especially here in the U.S., to stand up and make a stance on Palestine and being on our side means a huge deal for us. And we salute them for that. Again, in this particular time, it is Palestine. But we've always made the case that no one is free until we're all free. We're always going to stand up for every single oppressed person anywhere, in any region they are. So we salute them. And we know that this is not a fight of the rich, because they're benefiting out of it. Russia mentioned the boycott, the BDS movement. All of these major big companies and corporations, they're benefiting from the occupation between sponsorships and having an open market for them to sell their products. They're benefiting from the oppression of people, of Palestinians in Palestine and other regions in the world. And this is where it becomes our role, the working class, to stand up for all this oppression and injustices, to say, no, if you're going to support this kind of regime or this oppression, we're not going to support you. And that's what the working class for, that's what union is for. And again, it means a lot for us Palestinians. It means a lot for me personally to have a lot of people, unions, public opinion, especially here in the U.S., shift and actually see for themselves what's happening in Palestine. And it's been happening since 1948 till this day.
Rasha and Suhaib, thank you so much for being in conversation with us.
Thank you very much to both of you again. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Join us in the new year on January 25th, 2024, for the next episode of Economics for the People.
The views and opinions aired by the hosts and guests on the show do not reflect those of their employers, KKFI, or its board. I'm not.
الرضع صار الوضع بده الردع لكن كيف تتحرر مستوطن بتلمت لكن يوصف حكيت ألف كان ألف رقب الهدار الإعلام سلاح مطيب فبركوه أما لما ألمي يدي نرجع الواقع كما
دولوس نوس كاليانوس
Catrileo o al mapo, mil veces venceremos del cielo al suelo y del suelo al cielo vamos.
Zau, 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 zau.